From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our tribute to Spalding Gray, who practically invented the now popular genre of the onstage autobiographical monologue. Gray disappeared in January, and earlier this month his body was found in New York's East River. His family believes it was suicide. He never recovered emotionally or physically from a car accident he was in 3 years ago. We'll feature excerpts from Gray's interviews on Fresh Air, recorded over the past 19 years while he was performing his monologues Swimming to Cambodia, Monster in a Box, It's a Slippery Slope, and Morning, Noon, and Night. We remember Spalding Gray coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we conclude our two-part tribute to the late actor and monologist Spalding Gray. He developed a style of onstage autobiographical monologue that was emulated by so many other performers that became a genre. He was the best. Depression was something he fought all his life, but the depression combined with physical pain became unbearable after a car accident in 2001 that shattered his hip, fractured his skull, and injured his brain. When he disappeared in January of this year, his friends and family feared he had killed himself by jumping into the river. His body was found in New York's East River on March 7th. We're going to listen back to excerpts from several of Gray's Fresh Air interviews, starting with the 1985 conversation we recorded when he was performing his most famous monologue, Swimming to Cambodia, which was filmed by Jonathan Demme a couple of years later and became an art house hit. In addition to performing his own work, Gray co-starred in several films including True Stories, The Killing Fields, and Beaches, and he played the stage manager in a Broadway production of Our Town. But he wasn't quite cut out for conventional acting. In his monologue Swimming to Cambodia, he talked about why. The monologue was about his experiences making the 1984 film The Killing Fields about the Cambodian genocide. Gray played an aide to the American ambassador. Let me ask you, from your monologue, I get the impression that one of the pastimes in off hours was smoking Thai marijuana.
Some people did that, yeah.
And I get the impression from you that it makes you paranoid when you smoke it. So I guess my question is, why did you smoke?
I'm fascinated by psychotic states and have been for years. My mother had a very severe nervous breakdown and eventually committed suicide in 1967 after a two-year period. And not just because of that, but I've always been interested in abnormal psychology, and I guess it's something that I would do in another lifetime. I'd be interested in going into being a therapist. And I know that sometimes I get bored with health, with life as it is. It gets flat. And I often think that the marijuana is a perfect way to break through and go into that other realm. And then it's then afterwards I always repent and say, now, why did I want to do that? But within that, sometimes there's a number of very wonderful experiences happen in the sense of being able to let go with the perfect moment that I describe in the Indian Ocean, where I am not holding on to anything and I'm able to open up and feel this terrific at oneness. So it can go sometimes either way. And that way it was healthy and I was outdoors. But usually it is a kind of grinding paranoia that keeps me awake. And certainly I really understand my personal paranoid state and am tired of it and bored of it. I'd rather go on to other things. And that's why I like Swimming to Cambodia as a monologue. I think it's the first monologue that has transcended the personal neurosis because it is, God, it's so involved with that other world condition that is so much bigger. It's very humbling. You know, I don't get as involved, dwell so much on personal neurosis when I think about that Cambodian genocide.
You play yourself when you're doing a monologue.
Aspects of myself.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And your experience is really transformed in it. It's not a literal rendering of what happened.
Right.
But when you're in real life, do you ever feel like you're playing yourself too?
I will play often with Renee. I will do it where I'll act depressed. When I'm mildly depressed, it's as though I'm one of those people that makes histrionics to avoid anxiety, because when the anxiety is inarticulatable, then you make up a new histrionic anxiety to cover the one that you're not really getting to, and it's an overlay of histrionics there that has become a performance for me. It could go the other way and try to cut that away and go into therapy. At this point in my life, I think I've made a career of it, and wouldn't be interested in doing that. But I remember I have a monologue called A Personal History of the American Theater, and in it I say, you know, some people are born people that just born people, and they make a decision to become a lawyer or a doctor or an actor, and they go to school and they study it, and they're professional. For others, it's an ontological state. I was one. I hate to admit this, I say in the monologue, but I saw life as a flat thing, and I would theatricalize it by taking cues from the outside world. I'll give you an example. It's 4th of July. I'm a young kid, and I hear a few fireworks go off. Boop, 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 and I rush to the window and go, Mom, Mom, come quickly. Rush Jaman, our neighbor, is up on his roof shooting his kids. And this was before that happened a lot, you know. in the old days before it really happened a lot. And my mother would rush to the window, believe in me for a moment, you know. I would draw Hurrian onto it, and she'd go, oh, Spuddy dear, don't. You know, why? You know, why do you have to do that? So right from an early age, I was theatricalizing my life for whatever reason. And finally it turned into performance art. And what I was really doing was autobiographic work. I wasn't so interested in studying a character and doing that. And I remember my first experience of autobiographic theater was the first play I was in called A Curious Savage in boarding school, where I had to make took place in an insane asylum. I thought I was Hannibal. I was supposed to have delusions of grandeur, and I thought I could play the violin, and I was just sawing at it. And I started to do this downstage left cross, and there was a carpet on the floor that wasn't there for rehearsal, and it had squares on it. And I just did this improvised hopscotch in character or out of character, whatever. I hopscotched across the rug. And the audience went wild. And right then I realized the terrific power of the initiation, that I had created a performance piece within that overall play. And then it was years after that before I thought of lifting the hopscotch out of the context of other people's scripts and becoming an autobiographic performer. You know, too, it was a long evolution. But I look back on that as one of the original, not that everyone improvises, they all improvise, but they try to put it as a gestalt with the text. I finally began to want to bring that out and make it my own.
Didn't you audition for that TV series Hail to the Chief, in which
Patty Duke plays the president?
Definitely
part of the monologue. I was the dark horse from the East. I can't believe they brought me out there. I get out there. They put me up in the Beverly Hilton. They want me to play Patty Duke's husband. She's the first president in Hail to the Chief. Now, the only person, they boil it down to me and Dick Shawn. There's two of us. And I can't believe this. I'm very nervous, and I haven't memorized my lines. I should have. I didn't work real hard on it. Dick Shawn's got his lines down. And so they're rushing us in like the bullfights, and we have to come in front of all the producers are sitting there in the dark, and you have to come out in this arena in front of them, and they're sitting in these big leather chairs judging you with it. And so they rushed me down. They thought I was on next, and I got there early. And had to sit outside the room and hear Dick Shawn doing his thing. And nothing could be worse. First of all, everyone was laughing. Second of all, he had memorized his lines. Thirdly, he knew Patty Duke and was able to put his arm around her. And I came in. I hadn't memorized my lines. I was so stiff. I felt like a Kennedy. You know, I mean, with my New England accent. And I thought, well, if they want to go that way, fine. But I remember putting my arm around Patty Duke and feeling my arm was made of plastic, you know. And yet in my monologues, I'm very free, which made me believe I was not ready to make the jump, that somewhere in me I was, you know, Dick Shawn was ready. He was there. Hey, he was there for the work. He got it. Actually, he didn't get the, he got another role in the CIA agent or something. But the point is that when I'm really in a space and I know my material and I trust the people, I can be wholly present there. But if I were to get that job and I would have to sign a 6-year contract, it's not that I'm holding back from that. I would like to be accepted, but I realize I'm pretty esoteric. I was screened 2 hours for the Johnny Carson show, and I realized that I a lot of my material is really just too much for the average American audience.
Spalding Gray recorded in 1985 when he was performing his monologue Swimming to Cambodia. We'll hear a 1990 interview with Gray after a break as our tribute continues. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering actor and performance artist Spalding Gray, who's best known for his autobiographical monologues. Our next interview excerpt comes from 1990, when he was performing his monologue Monster in a Box. The Monster was the 1900-page manuscript of a novel he'd been working on for several years. The monologue was all about the interruptions he faced or created for himself while he was supposed to be completing it. Before I talked to him about that monologue, he performed a short excerpt from it.
So I got this contract to write this book, and it started to turn into this huge autobiographic novel, and I knew that that's all I wanted to do, because I had this idea that I'd been doing monologues for so long that I was too extroverted, and I want to get more introverted, in touch with my private self, and work in a more private way of writing, and I thought, I'll just do the book. In order to do the book and be private, I thought I would apply to a writer's colony, and I applied to the McDowell Colony in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and I thought, if they accept me, that'll prove I'm a writer. And they did accept me. And I was very excited because, well, a number of great writers had gone there, including Thornton Wilder, who had written Our Town and had modeled the town of Peterborough, New Hampshire, and as the town for Grover's Corners. And I arrive at 600 acres of land with about 52 private cabins on it. Each person has their own little house to work in. And it was wonderful. You could do anything in that house. I mean, no one could bother you. There was no telephone. They brought you lunch and delivered it in a little basket, put it on the steps and tiptoed away like Yogi Bear and left you alone. You could do anything in that house, which was fantastic for me to consider, being in a house and being able to do anything I wanted in New England. That was unique. So I began the writing process, and basically I hated it. It was dreadful. I was writing 3-4 hours a day longhand, doing the book longhand. I mean, I wanted to isolate myself up there, just write. No living, just writing. And I'm writing away, and I'm beginning to have my knuckle swelling from the pressure of the pen. My knuckle is swelling up and becoming arthritic from so much writing, and then I'm beginning to lose my sight in my left eye. And this makes me very upset because the book I'm working on is all about my Oedipal themes, and I think, oh no, there goes the first eye. So I'm writing, and then when I can't write anymore, it's 3 hours, 4 hours, I'm walking. What do? I walk in the woods, and I walk, and I walk, and I get back to the main house where we're supposed to eat dinner, and I drink, and I eat, and I reread what I wrote, and I get up in the morning, and I write, and I walk, and I drink, and I drink, and I drink, and I eat, and I reread what I wrote, and I get up in the morning, and I write, and I write, and I write, and I write, and I drink, and I drink, and I drink, and I eat, and I reread what I wrote, and I drink, and I drink, and I drink, and I was thinking, anything, get anything, please, something get me out of here. Someone call me and get me out of this place. So I got a telephone call at the main house asking me to come out to Los Angeles to do a project that the Mark Taper Forum Theater had applied for a grant to have me out there to do a year ago. Wonderful. They had applied to the National Endowment for the Arts. That was back in the old days when the NEA was doing wild and crazy things like that, investing in people like Spalding Gray. And the idea was that I would come to Los Angeles and look for people who were not involved in the film industry and interview them on stage. It was to be called L.A. The Other, just talking to simple folks about living in L.A. I was supposed to ride the buses of Los Angeles to find them. So I thought, this is wonderful. It'll get me out of here. I'll work on my book in the morning in Los Angeles, and then in the afternoon, I'll go looking for L.A. The Other. So I get out there. The Mark Taper Forum rents Renee Shafransky and I this Hollywood bungalow in the Hollywood Hills, a tiny little house. And the one thing I find fantastic, it has a view. I never knew how important a view was to me. I mean, in New York City, I have a view of a roof, a tar paper roof in another building. At the McDowell Colony, I was looking out at trees. Suddenly, I have this view of a snow-capped mountain in 20 miles in the distance, a city with a mountain by it with snow on it, when you could see it the 7 clear days of the year. And I'd wake up in the morning, and it was beautiful, the birds chirping and the wind chimes, and see the sun coming through the bedroom window. And I'd get up and go in to my writing table and sit down with my book and feel the sun coming across the desk, across my arms, and follow the sun, and follow the sun around into the living room, and sit down and watch the sun come through the cypress trees, and watch the sun come through the palm trees, and have a cup of coffee, and have another cup of coffee, and watch the sun come round and come through the dining room, and watch the sun go down through the dining room window and have a martini, and watch the sun set into the Pacific Ocean and have another martini. Why go out? Why bother? Why work on a book?
Spalding Gray performing an excerpt of his monologue, Monster in a Box. By the way, a filmed version of that monologue is available on video. I asked him to describe that novel he was trying to write.
It's an odyssey of a guy, as I refer to him, a guy who's trying to become a man, by learning the art of hanging out and taking pleasure and joy in the simply being able to be alone in a vacation setting or a paradisical session. His one problem is that he's never really worked much before, so it's kind of a contradiction in terms to say that he wants to learn how to take a vacation, but I like the title, Impossible Vacation. And he feels that he can't commit to the woman he's with, Cleo, his girlfriend, and try to settle down and have a family until he takes this one last big trip alone where he learns how to be a guy hanging out, and he's set on doing it in Bali. And he's taking the money, finally, that his mother's left him after she committed suicide,
And then it's all of those misadventures on the way of this odyssey in which he remembers back. It's flashbacks of remembering. So it's about the women in his life, of which there are three major relationships. His mother, a woman after that, and then Cleo, the one that he's with then. And so that's kind of the plot. And then it's about every kind of phobia and digression. And it's about obsessive behavior and drinking and obsession with beer and getting drunk and all of those male things.
And all those things
and
that
sex,
you probably have, right?
And masturbation,
right?
And all of those things. All of those that I had now. I've stopped drinking, and because of that, and I'm older, so I masturbate less. Or maybe, I don't know what's caused the decline in masturbation. I think it was an eye operation I had on my left eye, actually.
So experiencing pleasure is something you have talked about in your monologues, right? As always having problems with. You're always looking for the perfect moment, never quite finding it. Did you take a vacation this summer? Did you get away?
I took a vacation, but it was for 10 days, and it was the strangest one I've ever had. It was in Amagansett on Long Island, in a small cottage, very teeny little shack on a salt pond, very beautiful setting. And I didn't vacate. You see, I gave up drinking for the first time, alcohol, since 1976. And I have never lived in a summer in my adult life where I didn't at least have a lot of white wine with fish. I mean, they go hand in hand. And I was also told by one doctor, I've been to many, there's a whole other monologue in that, that I had a high level of mercury, so I had to cut out all big fish because that's problematic with the cataracts. And so all of a sudden, there goes tuna fish, swordfish, and salmon. And I'm out there in the water, and I'm not drinking, and I'm getting prepared for an eye operation, so I could hardly call it a vacation. So Renee said, well, we'll try to take one to Costa Rica because the beaches are beautiful in January after you finish your long run at Lincoln Center. So, and when she said that, the beaches are beautiful, Costa Rica, I got panicked because, again, I feel that enormous pressure to have these ultimate perfect moments, and I don't want to do that. What I'm leaning more toward in my life now is, and I'm reading more and more Zen books. I think that's foolish. People read Zen, they should be practicing it, but I'm reading the books, getting ready to practice it, trying to find a more middle ground of the ultimate challenges, the Zen, the wonderful Zen story where the kind of flamboyant, magical Hindu is saying, boasting about how he can materialize jewels out of the air and walk on the water. And the Zen monk says, well, that's nothing. I do the ultimate miracle. When I'm hungry, I eat. When I'm tired, I sleep. So I think, well, if I can slow down and begin to experience simple joys and have everything more polymorphous, primorous, and everything like a vacation, that's what I ideally like, rather than this crazy thing of working and then trying to relax with a capital R, which is what America is all about and why it's so crazy. So I just don't know. The idea of a vacation frightens me. The best vacations for me are working on films, when I'm on a film set and I'm doing a small role.
Right, because you don't have to work that hard.
It's enforced, and you're with interesting people in a nice location, and they're feeding you well, and they're taking care of you, and then you do 2 or 3 days' work.
And you're under no obligation to really enjoy yourself, because after all,
right,
you're working.
That's
right.
The obligation, exactly. That's what gets it.
Does knowing that you're reporting on your life ever enhance the pleasure of it, or do you think it distances you more from...
I think it distances me, and, one of the particular books I was reading on Vipassana meditation this morning, and I'm starting to get more interested in that, was that they say, are you one of those people that when you're walking in the woods, you're thinking about what a great story this will make for your friends? And I underlined that in green ink, and I thought, but wait a minute, that is my profession after all. And after all, I do enjoy telling stories, and after all, I'm very present when I'm telling the story. So what I see myself as doing is that's a form of sacrifice. It's part of the work. But I do find it's a distancing.
I've been watching your performances for a long time. I remember back in, I guess it was 77, you did something called Rumstick Road.
Right.
And it was a two-person piece.
No.
Three persons?
Four, actually.
Four,
if you count
okay.
The technician who was on stage.
Which I didn't,
yeah.
Yes.
Right. He was supposed to be part of the show.
Well, anyways, this was largely about your mother, who was a Christian Scientist, and her suicide.
Right.
And it was presented more, like tragedy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was drama. It was not. Mm-hmm. It was not a humorous monologue,
right,
in any way. Over the years, I guess as time has gone by, you're still talking about your mother,
right,
in your work and her influence on you and her suicide. But it's taken this kind of like dual nature.
Yeah.
It's both tragic and comic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could talk about how the
process of that.
Yeah, the process of humor
starting
to enter into something.
That's an interesting and good question. And I've talked about it a few times when I've done public talks about the work, but I think that I went through an extremely healing process through art in regards to the suicide, because I did go through the depression, not being able to mourn it, and all of the stuff that they talk about. And when I co-founded the Worcester Group with Elizabeth LeCompte in New York City in the Performing Garage in 1977, we were working on a series of autobiographical pieces. And that sprung me out. And every night at the end of that, I would walk out like Jimmy Durante in three spotlights and wave goodbye to the entire, you know, even now I get choked up thinking about it, to the audience, to the group, and walk out the garage door, the Performing Garage door. And around that time, 1979, I was doing my first monologue. And I didn't know that they were going to be funny. But my New England timing, my New England accent, my New England understatement was funny to all the New York Jews. If I had stayed in Boston and done them, no one would have laughed. You know, it saved me. There, that audience, the New York audience, saved me and gave me my sense of humor. So that helped birth it.
Spalding Gray recorded in 1990 while he was performing his monologue Monster in a Box about the distractions that kept him from completing his novel Impossible Vacation. In the second half of the show, we'll hear the conversation we recorded after Impossible Vacation was finally published as we continue our tribute to the late Spalding Gray. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Aveda, an earth-conscious beauty company committed to preserving natural resources and finding more sustainable ways of doing business. Information available at aveda.com. And from Knopf, publisher of The Fabric of the Cosmos, the new book by Brian Greene, author of The Elegant Universe. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our tribute to Spalding Gray. We'll hear excerpts of the interviews he recorded about his novel Impossible Vacation and his monologues It's a Slippery Slope and Morning, Noon, and Night. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're remembering actor and performance artist Spalding Gray, who's best known for his autobiographical monologues. His body was found earlier this month in New York's East River, an apparent suicide. He never physically or mentally recovered from injuries he sustained in a car crash in 2001. Gray turned his life into theater, transforming his neuroses, phobias, health crises, depressions, quests, and relationships into stories that were very funny and also very moving. In The New Yorker, he was once described as the perfect raconteur for our times. Today we're listening to excerpts from the interviews he recorded on Fresh Air. When we left off, we were talking about his monologue Monster in a Box, about the distractions that kept interrupting work on his novel Impossible Vacation. When that novel was finally published in 1992, we spoke again. I know you got married last August.
Right.
To Renee Shafransky, who's been your longtime companion and also your longtime collaborator. Right. Do you mind talking about why you decided to do something formal and get married?
Yes, well, that's part of the new monologue, Grey's Anatomy. And what it had to do with was this. When I was having my eye operation, Renee found it very difficult to have access to me because she was known as the girlfriend. And she says, you're getting older. You probably will be in the hospital in the future. I think I should be the wife so that they'll let me in to see you. It just is easier that way. And we actually went into therapy and talked about it. And I proposed to her in therapy. I proposed by saying, do you still really want to get married? And I asked her, and she giggled and I saw that she really did, and that was important for her. And I thought that I could do it, even though I didn't understand why I didn't want to do it. And now I probably am understanding that more, because what we were before was a safer thing for me. It was like what you refer to as agricultural time. It's more circular, in which we'd reconnect through various anniversaries and seasons. And the marriage felt to me like a dart that was going straight, linear, toward a dartboard that could only be interrupted by two D's, death or divorce. And so there was a line there that was supposed to make you feel more secure, and I think it does, Renee, but in me, made me feel a little more claustrophobic. And so I think that's the difference in the experience that we've both had. And all at the same time, she doesn't like calling me her wife. She does not like that word, so I'm now referring to her as my ex-girlfriend.
What kind of, you know, a lot of people, like, write their own marriage vows.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and so some of them, I have to say, with all due respect, are just, like, really corny and a little bit embarrassing. So how did you decide to go about that?
This was a very beautiful ceremony. I have to say, a week before it, I almost drowned. And that was quite an experience because there was no lifeguard. We were going to get married on the beach. I almost drowned off the... Look, I knew there was a lot of turbulence coming up around the marriage because when we went out to select the house to get married in, it was wintertime. And we were out there alone, and I had a dream that I was lying on a pile of ashes and that my body was filtering into the ashes and the ashes were coming up into my body and there was no separation. And when I woke up, I thought, what were those ashes? They were shaped like a sleeping bag, like a mummy bag, like a mummy. Oh, God, oh, God. I thought, I'm not free of her yet. And that was the dream that first came around trying to select the house in which to get married. Then, as we get closer to the marriage, I almost drowned, and there was no lifeguard. And Renee started yelling for men on the beach, and the reason that they went out is because they recognized my head from the poster Swimming to Cambodia.
Oh, no.
Yes, because it looked like the poster. It was as though I was reliving the poster. And this guy, a chiropractor from Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, first reached me with a yellow boogie board, and I grabbed onto that, and they pulled me in, and they all wanted to photograph me on the beach, standing next to them, saying, if you ever do a monologue, please include my name. I'm the chiropractor from Punxsutawney. And so the closer I got to the marriage, the more I started to get into these panic things, and then just 5 days before the marriage, a major hurricane hit, if you remember this, and tore everything apart, all the marriage plans. And I said to Renee, I see this as a sign. And she said, I see it as a challenge. And this is the difference between the two of us. She rallied her forces. She outdid that hurricane. She brought that whole wedding together. And it was a very beautiful ceremony. And it was on the beach that it was. And it came, the sun came out, and we were drinking champagne, and our lawyer married us. And he wrote the ceremony based on all of the things that had happened leading up to the marriage, the hurricane, the almost drowning, not the ashes dream, and said that quote, you know, Renee saw it as a challenge, Spaulding saw it as a sign. But he really talked about being together for as long as the two of you shall love. And it was a very a simple, beautiful ceremony that simply retraced our history together. And then we signed the papers right there on the beach with the wind blowing and everyone standing around. And it was a small ceremony. And I have to say, the marriage itself was beautiful. You know, the wedding was beautiful, but the wedding is one thing, marriage is another. And people must remember that that's two very different things. The marriage is ongoing. The wedding was for a day. I'd love to get married once a year. Again, you know, to Renee, it was a lovely party, and all the sun came out and all things blessed us. All things blessed us.
Spalding Gray recorded in 1992 after the publication of his novel Impossible Vacation. He returned to Fresh Air in 1996 when he was performing his monologue It's a Slippery Slope, in which he described a turn his life took that stunned me. At the end of your new monologue, you confess that you were having an affair with another woman at the time you were married, and that in fact, while you were married, she became pregnant with your baby, and you've since left Renee, and you're living with the woman who you had a son with. Her name is Kathy, and you're living together, and in fact, you're expecting another child in January. This is such a surprising thing to hear.
Yeah, it was a surprising event for me to have happen. If you think that I can fill you in on what I think the underneath of all of that is, I think I'm still processing it, but what is the specific question?
Well, I'm not sure. I think part of the question is that for the first time I felt myself, instead of just kind of identifying with you and say, boy, that's Spalding, he really understands neurosis.
Right.
I was thinking, boy, that's Spalding, he did something that really upsets me.
Right.
You know, I'm
right.
really upset that he was having an affair while he married Renee. I don't know Renee, but I feel like I know her through your monologues. Through having followed your life, I know something about her life, and she feels like a friend, you know, in the way that characters in books that you read feel like friends. I feel like, well, you know, you betrayed my friend, and I don't feel good about that.
Right. So how are you feeling now?
Well,
I mean,
still processing it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that you don't pay a lot of attention to my life because you have your own and you have other people that you interview. But that's been, when I say common, I mean, it's been a common response from women that I've gotten letters and people have spoken to me about it. And I expected that to happen because I felt that too. And this monologue is a watershed monologue in this sense that I would say that what happened to me, and this isn't a disclaimer, and it sounds a little Jungian and romantic, but not a midlife crisis. My press bite on the monologue is, it's about surviving a midlife crisis by finding my balance on skis. I think midlife crisis is another one of those American pop psychology words to make things lighter, as in Peter Pan complex versus the pura eternus, which is a little deeper in the sense of perpetual child, a more Jungian concept. And I'd say what happened to me was I really encountered my shadow in a major way. And it was not just the affair with Kathy in the midst of getting married that set these things, that triggered a lot of this breakdown. And the story of the breakdown, and it's not something I lay on you, it's not in the monologue, but it is a very long and complicated tale about me really collapsing around that period for all sorts of reasons, for overload situations that were probably exacerbated by the affair. But when I do the monologue, I want to keep the audience laughing. I'm trying to keep that balance between shadow and light. But there are places that are very complicated that I probably could go into write about. But Renee left me. And for good reason. I mean, she had no choice. But I can remember one of the crisis points was that I was bicoastal at the time. A lot of this was going on. So I had two therapists. I had one in New York City and one in Los Angeles. And at the time, Renee and I were in Los Angeles, and I have amnesia around a lot of this because I was pretty out there. Why we were there, I don't know. But I remember going into my therapist and not being able to sit in the chair. I was bouncing out of the chair, pacing around the room, rolling on the floor, letting out with yellings, involuntary yelps. And he said he needed Renee to come in the following day. And the following day she came in and said, the reason I brought you in is that you are his wife. You are legally responsible for him. And I would suggest that you get a legal separation because he is about to be put in a straitjacket. We have a law here in California. I want to call it the 510 law, but that's the Berkeley area code. But I'm not great at numbers, but it's one of those codes that if you have the kind of behavior he's manifesting in public, he can be put away. And that's what it looks like is about to happen. And we can't, commit him now. So this is when Renee did a legal separation. It was right after he said that. And she had organized friends of mine to go to California when I'd been in various hold-up situations. In the monologue, I talk about myself going out to California and her calling to say she'd seen Kathy with a baby. But in fact, also, she was going to have three friends go out and have me committed a number of times. And she would not have been off base on that. So a lot of stuff was happening. I mean, I feel very, very fortunate to be back in the saddle. And the woman that I'm seeing now as a therapist is a very strict and imaginative Jungian, and she is saying, stay off the lithium, which I was on, stay off the Klonopin, stay off the anti-Tourette's drugs. I was on three different drugs. You have just wrestled with your shadow and won. You have survived your mother's suicide. You've survived your mother's death. You and Renee were in a fused relationship. There's no way that couldn't have gone down. Now, I'm not a nice guy, and I wasn't a nice guy there. And where this monologue is different from the others is I'm no longer the infantilized child turning the audience into a mom, in particular the women, and saying, hey, look at me, I'm drowning. Renee loves me. She gives me unconditional love, and I always come back to her. But also, look out, I'm going out again. And so all of that behavior that I talk about in this monologue was going on all the time in the others, but you didn't know that. And I'm not a nice guy, Terry.
Well, see, that's the thing. I was picking up on that in the monologue. Yeah. Well, you know,
Spalding Gray recorded in 1996 while he was performing his monologue, It's a Slippery Slope. We'll hear his final Fresh Air interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Today we're remembering the late actor and performance artist Spalding Gray. The final interview I recorded with him was in 1999, after his monologue Morning, Noon, and Night, in which he described his new life as a father. It was a revelatory experience.
You know, you say that children led to what you call the double chaos factor. Explain what the double chaos factor is.
When I lived in New York City with two previous relationships before, two women, Elizabeth LeCompte and Renee Shafransky, in both cases there were no children, but there was a lot of work. We were doing intensive work, and I was also out in the city alone a lot. I would take long walks and be enthralled by what I call the mystical chaos of New York City, that it should not be functioning, but it is. It's functional dysfunctionalism. To me, it was total constant theater. And I don't mean that in a cruel, distancing way, but in a way you have to do that with New York to cope with it. And that, of course, leads to irony and all the rest of the diseases. But here I was trouncing around New York, getting big hits of it. And then I would come home to the two women that were centering and calming me and nurturing me. And so, in a way, I was the child in that relationship. Once there were children in the loft, it was totally chaotic. And also, they weren't acknowledging me in the same way. And Kathy didn't have the same energy to totally aim at me. You know, if I'd come home from tour, I described this in It's a Slippery Slope. The chaos. Forrest was up on my desk naked, Marissa's running around singing her life in opera, and they notice me, but they don't go, oh, sit down, can I pour you a beer? Was it hard out on the road, honey? So all of that changed, you see, and I needed to get to a place that was where I could walk outdoors and there'd be some peace.
Well, do you feel like you've had to become less dependent in a way? Because like you said, in some ways you were the child in the relationship, expecting a lot of attention and nurturing from the woman in your life. But when you're a father and the woman in your life is a mother, a lot of that nurturing really has to go to the kid. So has that...
Well, I'm growing up. And it's really amazing to be growing up at almost 60. But I mean, an example of that would be that Kathy has a talent agency and she handles solo performers. And she was out booking at a booking conference in this Wednesday to Sunday in Kansas City. So I was with the children. Now, we have a babysitter that spells me in the afternoon, but I'm dealing with getting them off in the morning and getting them down at night. And the storm came, we had the hurricane watch that didn't really hit, and I have this little sailboat, you know, that I just love, a little beetle cat, a 15-foot day sailor that had to be taken out because of the storm, and then they didn't put it back in the next day. And I was saying to Kathy, but I wanted to go sailing today, and she goes, you're whining. And I thought, she's right. And I said, but what I need to hear from you is, oh, it's really, really rough. I'm sorry I left you. You're such a little pookies. And I'm just sorry the children. What she says instead is, you are so lucky to have such wonderful children. And I've covered you with the babysitter. And, you know, the underlying that is, as in, remember, grow up.
You always seem to need a lot of nurturing. Do you feel comfortable in the role of kind of being the nurturer as the father?
I do, yeah, because it's such a surprise that it's like a new part of me blossomed. So it's a dimension there. And I like it so much that I get nervous as Forrest grows. Forrest will be 7 on Monday, and he's much more independent. So then I need to see Theo being dependent on me so that I can still have that nurturing force going. And Theo is a less dependent child than Forrest was. It's interesting to see that. But I don't want to lose that. You know, I don't want to have it taken away from me by their independence.
You know, now when you're talking about your life, you're also talking about your whole family's lives.
Yeah.
Including your kids. And here's something I'm wondering about. You know, you explain in your monologues that your first son was born when you weren't even having a relationship with his mother, and then you got together again afterwards. Your second son, you at first opted for abortion, but then changed your mind. This is the kind of thing that parents often like never want their children to find out about.
Right.
And of course, I mean, this is like on the public record now. So I wonder how you feel about that, about your kids knowing this kind of stuff that outside of your art, you might not have wanted to tell them.
A couple of things, three things I think about. One is I've noticed that throughout the interview you've been using the word explain, and I wish that I was doing that. I feel that I'm reporting and not explaining. And the other was that I remember when Renee and I were still talking around and after the breakup, and we were having dialogues and having lunches together, and she said, I just can't wait till, because she says, when your son is a teenager, when Forrest grows up and sees your monologues published and sees the early dedications to Renee, and he's going to go, okay, I want to find out who that Renee is. And I thought, my God, Renee doesn't know me. After 14 years of living together and working together, she would think that I would, like, not do a monologue about this. Of course, at the time, I also thought it was impossible to do that. I think it's really, really good to get it out there and to pay attention, to really pay attention to his, in case Forrest's reactions. He saw Morning, Noon, and Night. He's a little bit aware of Slippery Slope, but he sat through the whole production of Morning, Noon, and Night. And afterwards, slowly things surface and there's a dialogue. But I'm very, very careful. And I think this is the only way you can go at it, is that you keep him, and I really don't know how to do this as he gets closer to being a teenager, but keep him conscious. You know, keep a dialogue going where I would answer the question by, you know, saying, this is how Daddy works, this is what I do, and this is, you know, hey, would you rather not be here?
Right.
It's not a bad life, Forrest. It is not a bad life.
And then Daddy's a drama queen.
This is how Daddy makes a living for us. Now, do you want me to do something else? Because we'll be living in quite a different situation. Are you ready to give up the big house and move into an outhouse?
Spalding Gray recorded in 1999 when he was performing his monologue Morning, Noon, and Night. We'll conclude our tribute with an excerpt from one of his performances after a break. This is Fresh Air. Spalding Gray was always in pursuit of a perfect moment, or at least a moment when he could get out of his head, stop thinking, and fully experience the moment. We'll end our tribute with an excerpt from his monologue, It's a Slippery Slope, about learning to ski, a sport which he threw himself into in his 50s and became obsessed with. Here he is, describing a day at Aspen, where he's been befriended by three locals, Maggie, her boyfriend Jake, and their friend Martha. They're all skiing down the big mountain Ajax.
Something's happening that is right. And Maggie's the provocateur. She keeps passing over a snuffed-out marijuana joint that she wants to relight every time we're on the lift, you know. No, thanks, really. That stuff just makes me think. Well, actually, think is the wrong word. I'd be a scholar if that was the case. It just makes me grind my gears, junkhead, around and around, garbage, nothing productive, really. I mean, if I was dancing all night at a club or something, I'd take it. But, Maggie says, really, Spalding, skiing is like dancing in the day. It's like dancing in the light. Don't say no, just say maybe. So next time round, Maggie and I are alone on a double lift, and she just passes it over, and I don't think about it. I just go, pass it back. And I begin to think so hard that I don't get off the lift, and it goes around. They stop, but I'm hanging up there. He goes, hey, rock and roll. Hey, man, having a good day? They're helping me down. The skis are falling off. They are too big, I'm thinking. And the marijuana is making them seem too big. But I have to say, in defense of the hemp, it really does loosen up my hips. Not that you're supposed to have loose hips when you're skiing, but boogie on down. I'm skiing with Jake now, and I like that. This new male thing, you know, because usually I always felt I had to talk to a guy. We're just skiing together, and I'm up at the top of the mountain waiting for Martha and Maggie to come up, and Jake says, I want to show you something. Oh, God, no, he's going to try to teach me something. Suddenly I feel like a frozen banana. No, he says, don't freeze up. You're doing fine in your turns, but you know what? After you turn, you're sliding down the mountain, and you're sliding down the mountain because you're not edging. Just watch me for a minute. I look over, oh, wow, I'm able to see it. I'm able to take it in. He rolls his skis in just slightly into the mountain and edges, and oh, yes, I'm behind him, and what a difference an edge makes. We are skiing now down Ruthie's Run, a terrain that was so steep I was simply crashing down it before, and now I am realizing that you have to be out of control to be in control. For a second, you have to be falling down that fall line and then catch yourself, and you have to have the leap of faith, and I never had faith in my life until that day. You've got to believe you're going to turn right in order to turn right, and it's leap of faith and around. Wow, I doubted everything until this moment, and leap of faith and I'm around, and I'm falling into the light, and I can feel the gravity pulling me, the earth, the mother, and leap of faith, I'm around, and leap of faith, I'm around, and leap of faith, I'm around, and Maggie shoots behind me with stereo earphones on, yelling, think of it as a white wall of death. And I'm able to keep my balance in the face of this, and I know where she gets her kicks, and I know she's hoping I'll do a monologue about this, and she will be in it. We have a wonderful afternoon. It's timeless. It's so energized. It's so... Oh, it's so... And they say, they bid farewell. They say, it's almost 4 o'clock. We got to run the mountain. You download. I said, no. I want to ski down with you guys. Spalding, you know what? It's really not safe. There's only one way down the mountain. At the end of the trail, it's Spa Gulch. And the locals refer to that often as the Valley of the Shadow of Death. It's icy. It's dark. The shadow comes in. Maggie blew her ACL tendons out last year. You could hear them pop up the gulch like hot spaghetti. Don't want to do it. I do. It's your choice. So I opt. What my plan is, I'm going to follow Martha, the blind ski instructor. I hadn't skied with her yet, ski instructor for the blind. She was like a sleek weasel, really, really smooth, fast, confident, and I'm right behind her. And what's exciting now is that we're running the whole mountain, so the rhythm starts to build. And before, we were just skiing around at the top, and we're starting down, and there's all this new terrain. And then as we get closer to Spa Gulch, I can see what they mean. The conversion is like an L.A. freeway. All the trails are going into that one place. And behind me, I can hear the snowboarders shredding, shear, shear, shear. And all of a sudden, Martha goes straight up the edge of the gulch and hops around and comes down, and I'm behind her. I don't know who's doing this. Are the skis skiing me? And I go up, and all of a sudden, I see a cobalt blue sky, a new moon, and whoop, I'm around. I see amber, bright sun on snow, and dark shadow, and down, and up, and around, and down, and up, and around, and up, and down, and up. Chung, 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 chung. Bow! Born out of the thighs of Ajax. And Jake comes over and gives me a big high five. My first.
Spalding Gray performing in 1996 at the Goodman Theater in Chicago, where he was recorded by This American Life. You can see photos and videos from his career and hear interviews about him on the website npr.org. Spalding Gray's body was found in New York's East River earlier this month in apparent suicide. His mind and body never healed from the car accident that shattered his hip, fractured his skull, and injured his brain in 2001. Before he died, he was working on a monologue called Life Interrupted, about life after the accident. I've been thinking about something he said in his monologue Monster in a Box, commenting on how he often complicated or screwed up experiences that were supposed to be simple and pleasurable. He said, "I like to create my own hells before the real ones get to me." Apparently, the accident created a real hell from which there was no relief, not even in the act of creating theater about it. I am one of his many fans who miss him and miss the privilege of listening in on the continuing story of his life. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's tribute to Spalding Gray was produced by Naomi Person with Patty Leswing. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by TIAA CREF, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide. TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Richard Clark, former counterterrorism chief for the Bush White House. In his new book, Against All Enemies, he criticizes the Bush administration for not paying attention to al-Qaeda before September 11th and for invading Iraq, although there was no evidence connecting it to al-Qaeda. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.